For the World's podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Running a small business is a lot of work. It takes time and money, and you want all the time and money you have to go towards growing your business. But what happens when legal hurdles pop up along the way? LegalZoom is there to help. Get advice for running your business from vetted independent attorneys and tax professionals available in all 50 states. The best part is you won't get charged by the hour since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan at LegalZoom.com now and get special savings when you enter the word world at checkout. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com.
Threat assessment today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Tensions between Iran and the U.S. are especially high right now, and critics of the Trump administration say that's not a coincidence.
So the president has made decisions that he knew would ramp up tensions in the region. It doesn't justify what Iran has done in response, but it's all very predictable.
Democrat Chris Murphy, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is my guest this hour. Also, life in the city of Idlib, the last battleground in Syria's civil war.
I don't know what to say more because we are not safe. We expect bombing at any moment.
Plus, in Armenia, one woman takes on the fight for transgender rights. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. President Trump says he does not want war with Iran, but his administration is still sounding the alarm.
This threat from Iran remains. We've had some luck in disrupting some of the tactical things that were in front of us, I think it's fair to say, but make sure we're still on high alert.
That's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking to CNBC today. Also today, Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan confirmed the Pentagon is considering a plan to send thousands of additional U.S. troops to the Middle East. All amid a debate on Capitol Hill over whether the administration is overstating any potential threat from Iran. Some Democrats think so, but the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Idaho's James Risch, does not agree with them.
The Democrats are dead wrong on that. And anyone who would say that the Iranians were not turning up the temperature in the last 2 weeks of April and the first week in May simply doesn't know anything about intelligence.
Senator James Risch talking to Fox News. One of the Democrats on that Foreign Relations Committee is Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut. He says that while Iran is acting belligerently, the U.S. response is not helping.
Well, we're doing nothing to calm the situation down. All we're doing is escalation, and it's blind escalation with no end game. I don't know that it, you know, makes a ton of sense to, you know, figure out who started it, except for the fact that, you know, the president was told by his military advisors that if he pulled out of the Iran nuclear agreement and he named the Iranian Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization, there would be increased threats on U.S. personnel in the region. That's the reason why President Obama did not make that decision and President Bush did not make the decision about the IRG. So the president has made decisions that he knew would ramp up tensions in the region. It doesn't justify what Iran has done in response, but it's all very predictable. And without a ability to talk to the Iranians, right, without a diplomatic channel, you risk a mistake being made. So, yeah, I believe them when they say they don't want war. But then why on earth are they taking all of these actions which could predictably lead to conflict even if they don't desire it?
We heard a British commander recently say that there was nothing really abnormal about what Iran was doing. But you were at a briefing that Secretary of State Pompeo and Defense Secretary Shanahan gave to senators on Iran. Did they provide any further evidence that Iran is posing this heightened threat right now?
So you know, my understanding is that the British have walked part of that back. I do think there's an elevated risk. Again, I just think that that elevated risk comes as a response to U.S. actions. And it was avoidable had we not pulled out of the nuclear agreement and taken this step to name the Iranian military as a terrorist organization.
So the U.S. has deepened ties with Saudi Arabia in recent years, Iran's archenemy. How do you think the U.S. relationship with Saudi impacts what's going on right now with Iran?
So we spend a lot of time, rightfully, talking about the threat that Iran poses to Israel. And there's no doubt that that regime still states that their mission is to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. That being said, Iranian missiles are primarily pointed at Saudi Arabia today. It is the Saudis that the Iranians are involved in an ongoing set of proxy wars with. And so every time that we sell more weapons to the Saudis, every time that we double down on our commitment to the Saudi side of that regional war for supremacy between the Saudis and the Iranians decide to double down in their commitment to building up their ballistic missile program, to supporting terrorist groups and proxy forces in the region that are fighting Sunni-backed forces. And it's just been amazing to me that, you know, frankly, both Democrat and Republican presidents haven't figured that out, that supporting the Saudis at the level that we are today is part of what drives the Iranian behavior in the region, and part of the reason why many of us are arguing for a changed relationship with Saudi Arabia as part of a strategy to de-escalate tensions with Iran.
Well, last night you tweeted that the president is considering using an obscure loophole in arms control law that would allow his administration to sell a new batch of bombs to Saudi Arabia without congressional approval. It has not happened yet. So why tweet about it now?
Well, to raise the alarm bells to try to make sure that it doesn't happen. I don't know whether it would be completely unprecedented, but the idea that the president would use a emergency in the Middle East as a means to circumvent congressional oversight of an arms sale is a very dangerous precedent. Frankly, there's always an emergency in the Middle East. And so if you could simply cite ongoing tensions or hostilities as a reason not to come to Congress to approve an arms sale, no president will ever come to Congress ever again. And that's very, very dangerous.
Senator, the work of your committee and of U.S. diplomats in the Middle East, do you think what you're all doing is held back by the fact that Washington is kind of overwhelmed by this feud between the White House and the House of Representatives?
It shouldn't be. I mean, I don't – listen, I think the fact that the president is, you know, claiming that he won't work with Congress at all until every investigation into his administration stops is ridiculous. At the same time, Congress has kind of put itself in this position of having difficulty weighing in on foreign policy. You know, Congress took itself out of the business of declaring war years ago. Once it got really messy to figure out who we were fighting and when the conflict ended, Congress decided that we'd just outsource decisions about military intervention to the president. And President Obama took that and ran with it, and President Trump is doing the same thing. So if we want to be more impactful on matters of foreign policy, it's within our power to, you know, step up and do something about it. Take away the president's power to, you know, unilaterally decide tariff policy, authorize military action against ISIS and other enemies in a way that, you know, creates some definition of what the president can and cannot do. We shouldn't just complain about what the president does. We actually still can pass legislation with a veto-proof majority if we have enough members. We should try to do that.
Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks.
John Walker Lind spent nearly half of his life behind bars. Lind became known as the American Taliban after being captured on the battlefield in Afghanistan. Today, he was released from federal prison in Indiana. He was serving a 20-year sentence for providing services to the Taliban, and he got out 3 years early for good behavior. That early release has drawn criticism from, among others, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
It was pretty shocking news in November 2001. 2 months after September 11th, a 20-year-old from California was captured with the Taliban in Afghanistan. John Walker Lind became detainee number 001 in America's so-called war on terror. Soon, his face was all over the news here in the U.S.
Conspiracy to kill a 20-year-old Californian who went to Pakistan to pursue Islamic studies and then went to war against the United States, tonight faces the possibility of life in prison.
A few months after Lind's capture, Attorney General John Ashcroft painted a picture of this young man as a committed extremist and a sworn enemy of his own country.
It is extraordinary for the United States to have to charge one of its own citizens with aiding and conspiring with international terrorist groups whose agenda is to kill Americans.
A grand jury indicted Lind on 10 counts, but the legal case against him did not go well. In the end, Lind wasn't prosecuted for terrorism at all. In fact, he never even went on trial.
They arranged a plea deal ahead of a hearing that was going to be about the way he was treated in U.S. custody.
Karen Greenberg is a national security law expert at Fordham University. She says Lind was interrogated before getting medical treatment for a bullet wound in his leg and mistreated in other ways.
I think that the passions were so high at the time that the thought of going through a trial may have been something that led him to a plea deal on his side, and that the thought of exposing how he had been treated may have been led to a plea deal on the government side. We don't know. This was all done in classified setting.
John Walker Lind pleaded guilty to supporting the Taliban. He spent the last 17 years in federal prison. Greenberg says, as far as she can tell, there's nothing amiss about his early release.
The way our criminal justice system works is that you are convicted of a crime, you are sentenced with the appropriate sentence, and once you've served your time, you're out.
But Lind has long been branded a traitor. In an appearance on Fox News today, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that Lind's early release was deeply troubling, and he alluded to the death of CIA officer Mike Spann, who was killed in a prison revolt in Afghanistan soon after he questioned Lind. Republican Senator Richard Shelby from Alabama wrote a letter to the White House saying that Lind, quote, is believed to have had direct involvement in Spann's death. I put that contention to Karen Greenberg.
That is patently not true. The judge in the case, who is a well-respected, renowned national security judge who handles many high-level cases with much classified information and takes national security as seriously as any judge in the country, has said that he was not accused of that, that that is not one of the charges. There was no evidence of this.
There are signs, however, that suggest Lind still holds some extremist views.
These U.S. intelligence assessments say he continued to advocate global jihad while in prison. In this letter to NBC4 Los Angeles in 2015, seen tonight for the first time, Lind expressed support for ISIS and said, quote, they are doing a spectacular job.
Those are troubling allegations, says Bennett Clifford. He's with the program on extremism at George Washington University. I asked him if he thinks Lind represents a terrorism threat now that he's out of prison.
I believe so. I think that left unchecked, he would pose a relatively significant danger to the community. But it's hard to assess that in light of what the types of restrictions that probation services are putting on him.
For at least 3 years, Lind will not be able to get a U.S. passport. His internet activity will be closely monitored, and he'll need to see a mental health counselor. Still, Clifford is concerned. He says Lind might not be a terrorist mastermind, but that he wouldn't need to be.
What recent events have shown, especially if you look at things like the 2015 shooting in San Bernardino, the 2016 Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, is that the line between somebody that's aspirational and somebody that can carry out an effective and deadly attack is very, very thin. Ultimately, this makes it very difficult to determine whether somebody like Lind is a threat.
Clifford says Lind will be a test case, but there needs to be a better system for rehabilitating jihadist extremists, he says, because more than 100 federal inmates on terrorism-related charges will be released in the next few years. Kevin Lowry of the Federal Judicial Center in Minneapolis has worked on this issue for years. He says most violent extremism in this country is still committed by neo-Nazis and other white supremacist groups.
The jihadist-type extremist is a new phenomenon for us.
Lowry didn't want to comment on the case of John Walker Lind, but he says extremists of all kinds can be rehabilitated.
There's no magic solution, and there's no permanent solution. So there's at times we know that people have turned a corner and have been rehabilitated and have gotten as far away from extremism as possible. And then there's others that may relapse to it, just like with substance abuse or any other type of criminal behavior.
Lowry says nobody does this perfectly, but he's been working with experts in the UK, Germany, and Scandinavia on how to better deal with extremists being released from prison. For the World, I'm Matthew Bell.
India's prime minister claims a landslide victory at the polls. That's next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's 5 more years for India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi. After several weeks of elections, his party, the BJP, has won by a landslide. In many ways, the election was a huge win for democracy. More than 600 million people voted. But there are concerns his win could be divisive. Davina Gupta is host of the BBC India program Work Life India. She joins us from Delhi. How much of a surprise is this result?
A lot of it. In fact, if somebody went by the exit polls, they were predicting that the Hindu Nationalist Party of the BJP would come back. But the numbers have been quite a surprise because it's a landslide victory. And it's the first time since 1971 that a single party has been able to get such a majority consecutively. Now, I can just compare it with the style of politics that one is witnessing in the U.S. because this time round as well, it was a personality contest. India's Hindu Nationalist Party, the BJP, has a leader called Mr. Narendra Modi, who was the prime minister for the last 5 years and was seeking a second term. And his style of politics has been compared with Donald Trump as well. Both the leaders using national identity, catering to the constituents threatened by minority or diversity. It was also seen in India, particularly, that Mr. Modi was pushing sort of conservative politics. There were also speeches that he made which aimed at taking the Hindu national votes, which is about 80% of India is people who follow Hindu religion. So both the leaders also have deep business interest. They're hostile towards media. And another thing is that how they communicate with social media. So you would have Mr. Modi targeting his political rivals via Twitter. And looking at how he's been able to rein in the voters, especially at a time where the Indian economy is on a downslide.
At the top of the list, though, is, you said playing the national identity card.
What worked in his favor was just in the run-up to the elections, there was a terror attack in India-administered Kashmir, northern India, and that became his campaign. He projected himself as the security guard of the nation. Then he used the us versus them politics, where his supporters were nationalists or people who were concerned with India's interest. His critics and rivals, he referred to them as anti-nationals. There was also a hint of religious polarization because he was often seen visiting temples, offering prayers at Hindu shrines. He was photographed meditating, wearing the orange saffron robes, which is a holy color for Hindus. Mm. So that also helped him in reaching across to his voters.
Yeah, so some powerful optics there on the campaign trail. So for the BJP, if Hindus are true Indians, who are the others? Like, who is not seen as a full Indian?
Now, that's an interesting question because the BJP for long has practiced what their critics would refer to as Hindu first policy. In the last 5 years, there have been deep divisions in the country where the minorities, especially Muslims, which constitute about 170 million people in India, they have been targeted in different parts of the country. The BJP and particularly Mr. Modi has been accused of keeping silent and not acting tough, especially when people from minority were targeted and accused of killing cows, which is a symbol of Hindu reverence. And that's where Mr. Modi's critics have called him a leader who is soft on the right-wing players in the country. And that becomes a divisive line for us, which is the Hindus, and them, that is the minorities.
Yeah, and how troubling is that division? Because, I mean, India has a tragic mm-hmm. history of communal violence. Are people worried where this Hindu nationalism could lead?
This is an interesting question because one of the poll analysts has said that India is just like European Union. There are different cultures, different religion, different languages in each state. And the diversity so far has been a strength in India. So there were regional parties that represent interest of each communities. But this time round, there is only one dominant party in the system. And that means that there would be an aggressive leader. Mr. Modi, in his past record, has shown that he is a leader who takes no prisoners. He is a leader who practices politics without any hint of regret when he shows his religion in a country which is based on secular ideals. So going ahead, there is a threat that there could be more divisions. There could be a fear within the minorities, and that will also be a challenge.
Davina Gupta, host of the BBC India program Work Life India, on the line with us from Delhi. There are more than 2 million people from India living in the United States, according to census data. Pulkit Gupta is one of them. He's originally from Haryana in northern India. Pulkit now lives and works here in Massachusetts as a scientist. So, Pulkit, India does not let expats vote unless they physically return to India for the election. So how do you feel, first of all, about not being able to vote in this important election?
It's extremely frustrating. I'm a citizen of India. Not having my say in electing the government that's running our country is frustrating.
Yes, so despite that, how do you feel about this outcome, this landslide victory for Narendra Modi's BJP?
Yeah, it seems like Narendra Modi's juggernaut is not slowing down. And in many ways, it's not surprising. Although in 2014, the election was fought on the issues of unemployment, corruption, making India a better place to work. In a sharp contrast to that, 2019 elections were the most polarizing elections in the country, where there was a huge religious divide. And in spite of that fact, a Modi government winning a landslide majority, it's shocking in many ways.
Is it fair to describe you as a reluctant Modi supporter?
Yes, I would say so. And the reason for that is we had a very weak opposition where voters were left to wonder, if not Modi, then who else?
So what do you find appealing about Modi and what do you find unappealing about him?
You know, Modi is a very strong leader who's not afraid to take difficult decisions, which is, I think, his strongest points. But at the same time, the religious divide that Modi and the government has created is not good for the country.
How invested do you think in Indian politics are Indians living here in America? I mean, would you ever consider moving back to India?
Yes. Moving back to India is an option that is wide open for me. And that's why I think having a say in the policies or electing the government is very close to my heart. And I hope that one day we'll be able to do that.
So I know you can't speak for all Indians here in the U.S., but what have been the reactions among your friends here to the BJP victory?
You know, a lot of my friends were expecting a BJP victory, but not by such a big margin because of the reasons we just discussed, right? In our generation, nobody cares about the religious divide. Where would the temple be built? What we care about is how many jobs do we have? How's the economy doing? And surprisingly, in this election campaign, there was no talk about these issues.
So to sum it all up, Pulkit, I mean, is this a good day for India?
You know, I think it will be interesting to see. This is the second consecutive time where Modi government has come into power. And I think there are immense opportunities to transform the country. And we really hope that the promises that were made in 2014 will be fulfilled in this term.
Indian-American scientist Pulkit Gupta, who lives and works here in Massachusetts, sharing with us his opinions and thoughts about the election in India. Pulkit, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. ISIS has lost its capital in Syria, but still has the power to control lives there.
We saw children die in their mother's arms because of starvation from hunger. And when we left, we found they had huge stashes of food and all this stuff for a very select group of people.
A witness to the Syrian war that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The Syrian civil war has raged for 8 years. The consequences for civilians caught in the war are dire.
My brother, my youngest brother, is covering his ears because he don't want to hear the sounds of the bombing and the rockets.
We'll hear more from that resident of Idlib province just ahead. Her region is being targeted today in an air campaign launched by the Syrian government forces of Bashar al-Assad. But first, let's look at where the war stands right at the moment.
This is a war that has extinguished the power of adjectives to describe it and its horrors, and we don't see a lot of sign of that letting up.
That's writer Gail Tsimak-Lamon. The horrors she's referring to include bombing campaigns, accounts of torture, and the massive displacement of people across the region. Gail Simak-Lamon has traveled in and out of the country throughout the war and has just returned again from Syria.
So right now there is an air campaign in Idlib launched by the Syrian regime and its Russian supporters to take back the last stronghold. And this was an area that a ceasefire had held in, but that started to unravel toward the start of this year.
So you spent some time in Raqqa. It had been ISIS central. Listeners will remember the intense violence ISIS inflicted on the citizens there and then the fierce fighting for control of that city in 2017. What did you find there?
I visited Raqqa a year ago and then three times last year. And what you see now is a city that's gone from a ghost town to a real city. You really see cafes and restaurants and businesses and people trying to rebuild amid the significant destruction that faced Raqqa. And it's a story of very fragile progress, but real progress. And the big question now is security, because the U.S.-backed forces are facing this challenge of an ISIS that is seeking to regroup and to renew its attacks. And they have not successfully launched significant large-scale attacks, but they have been able to have car bombs or explosions go off in the last 6 months. And that is unnerving people for very obvious reasons, because at the end of the day, it's about moms and dads being able to send their children to school.
Right. I mean, speaking of moms, I mean, women under ISIS suffered some of the worst abuses. What were the attitudes of the women that you found in Raqqa today?
Raqqa is a city where you see women really pushing forward. One shopkeeper I met a year ago, she had was the only woman that had a shop that we found at the beginning. And now you see more. And what she told us a year ago was that they had come back from post-ISIS area and had really started again, right? She had built this business. She was supporting her two daughters on her own. And I was really worried that when we went back this time, the shop would be closed. And instead, Marco, we walked in. She has a teenager working for her and has a sewing machine set up. And she said she was open till 12:30 a.m. the other night after Ramadan because business was booming. And she was talking to me about how women are seeing all kinds of roles happen for them that they never did before, that including during the regime. And a mom I met 2 years ago, who's one of the strongest people I've ever met anywhere in the world, walked out of Raqqa 8.5 months pregnant. She said to me, you know, I lived under FSA. I lived under the regime. I lived under ISIS.
Free
this is the first time we see women really being heard when they have a complaint, really being heard when they want to push into new areas. So you do see the city where women are pushing forward for themselves.
So, Gail, you met a number of women from outside Syria who were ISIS followers. Can you tell us about a few of them and their attitudes now toward the Islamic State?
The last months of ISIS have changed the way some of these mothers who lived under ISIS see both Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, and the entire project of the Islamic State. One woman we met from Egypt, a 27-year-old mother of four, she said, "We saw children die in their mother's arms because of starvation from hunger. And when we left, we found they had huge stashes of food and all this stuff for a very select group of people. So they had juice and Pepsi while our children starved." Mm. And that versus so many of the other crimes, you know, ISIS committed, right? The Yazidi enslavement, beheading people, chopping people's hands off. The thing that seems to have really unnerved and really shaken the support among these women for Baghdadi himself is the idea that they allowed children to die of starvation when they could have prevented it.
Finally, what is the extent of the U.S. presence there now? I mean, it's estimated there are at least 1,000 soldiers there. Is their presence obvious?
It is not obvious, and it is the Oz-like presence that holds the whole thing together. The United States forces you do not ever see, but you all know they're there. Everyone talks about it, including this mother I met who's, you know, led her whole family out of Raqqa during the siege. And she kept asking me, what are the Americans going to do? You know, are the Americans going to stay? Because we need them to stay. Because without them, we would have Russia or the regime or ISIS or Turkey here tomorrow.
Author Gail Simak-Lamon, just back from Syria. Thanks very much.
Great to join you.
While Raqqa takes small steps to rebuild, a bombing campaign is underway several hundred miles to the west. The Syrian government and its ally, Russia, have launched air attacks on Idlib. In that province of a few million people is a college student who goes by the name Sarah. Not her real name. She uses Sarah for safety. This week, the air assault has killed 10 civilians, including 5 children in the town Sarah lives in, Kafram Bel. She reached out to us this morning as she heard the sound of warplanes approaching.
"We hide in the cellar when there is bombing, I and my family members. And we feel really terrified and scared. And my brother, my youngest brother, is covering his ears because he don't want to hear the sounds of the bombing and the rockets. When the bombing started, it was really horrible.
What's happening in this forgotten province of northwest Syria represents a huge escalation. A haze of smoke rising from the ground, marking a fresh wave of bombings.
No one can imagine the amount of pain that when you are sitting at your home and suddenly your home, you will be under the rubble of your home.
Death rains from the sky. As Russian jets provide top cover, Syrian helicopters drop barrel bombs. They seem to fall slowly, but they're full of explosives and shrapnel designed to maximize destruction.
Can you imagine such a thing? It's really horrible. And I don't know what to say more because we get tired of talking and without having any help, no one helps us.
Idlib province in Syria. I stopped the slaughter of perhaps 3 million people. Nobody talk about that. They don't talk about that.
We are not safe. We expect bombing at any moment. So this is not life. This is, I call it slowly dying. We are slowly dying. So these are innocent children. They are sitting under the tree of olives and they are trying to play, but they feel sad because what happened today, because today there was bombing.
Syria says it's targeting terrorists. Idlib is a nest of extremists. The U.S. once called it the world's largest al-Qaeda safe haven.
Those people who were killed yesterday, they are ordinary people. They are farmers, poor farmers. They are not terrorists to be killed like that. Because of this situation, this unsafe situation, I can't focus on my study. I am a fourth-year student on my last exam, after which I am supposed to be graduated. I don't know if I will reach that moment or not, because I am worried, I am afraid all the time. I cannot focus on my study at all. And we don't know if we will stay or not. We might be homeless and go to the borders between Syria and Turkey. We will be lost. We will be homeless. Only thinking about these ideas, these negative ideas, makes me about to cry. It's really clear that no one cares about our souls, our blood. We are worthless for people, for the world. In fact, we are humans. We have dreams, we have lives, we have hopes, we have futures to live for.
The thoughts of one young woman in Idlib, Syria today, where airstrikes have been ongoing. Her story was produced by The World's Joyce Hackle and Lydia Emanalidou. Voters in the UK and the Netherlands went to the polls today to choose their representatives to the European Parliament. Voters in other EU countries will follow suit over the next few days. Aside from the whole Brexit saga in the UK, this election is significant for another reason. Far-right candidates across Europe are expected to do well. Results from all 28 countries where voting is taking place are expected by Monday morning. Susie Dennison is with the European Council on Foreign Relations in Paris. We reached out to her to hear if there's an appetite for more far-right policies in the European Union right now.
I think the reason that these parties are doing well is because they're tapping into what's going on emotionally in the European electorate at the moment. The big characterizations that voters give us in survey data about how they feel about the world are fear, stress and optimism. And I think the reason that these far-right parties are looking like they're going to do well in the elections this weekend are that they cover all three of those bases. They talk about the stress, the anxiety that Europeans have about economic insecurity, about an increasingly volatile, dangerous world. They talk about the fact that voters feel disconnected from the political system at both national and European level, and they offer a different vision of that future that they feel they can deliver on. So I think their strategy is working quite well at a campaign level, but the big challenge will be working together in the European Parliament if they do win, as is expected, around a third of the seats.
It's kind of a head scratcher why far-right leaders are even interested in having a presence in the European Parliament. I mean, aren't these groups naturally Eurosceptic, focused on keeping power domestically in their countries?
Right. I mean, they're all very much rooted in the domestic politics of the countries that they come from. But what we've seen since 2016 and the Brexit vote in the UK is a transition in the way that they talk about Europe. Back in 2016, I counted 15 different nationalist parties who were pushing for a referendum on their country's membership of the European Union. But now very few of these parties are actually asking for that. What they're saying instead is that they recognise that many European voters, 68% of Europeans, believe that their country's membership of the EU is a good thing. So I think that these parties are kind of recognising that, recognising that being able to cooperate as a continent in a world of superpowers like the US, China and Russia is important to voters. But still, they're picking up on the fact that currently people just don't see the EU institutions delivering. And that's why they've got this change agenda.
So what are the major issues that these right-wing leaders want to put on the EU Parliament agenda?
Their big headline areas of agreement are that there's a need for more control of immigration into the EU, that there is a need for more attention to be paid to terrorism, and then a need for national governments to be doing more on economic growth and so on. But I think, you know, what is important is to notice that, in fact, those areas of concern aren't that different from the concerns of voters for pro-European parties. The real challenge will be in whether or not the parties that are elected can make a change on these issues.
Let's talk personalities for a second. Do you see anyone emerging as a possible leader of the far right in Parliament, and will they have any challengers?
This is a big problem because there are a lot of big personalities involved. The leader of the pan-European alliance that is emerging is indeed Matteo Salvini in Italy, and he's invested quite a lot of time in this idea of cooperation between the different far-right forces. He's convened conferences in Milan and elsewhere, but other more long-established leaders of the anti-European parties, like Viktor Orban in Hungary, like Marine Le Pen in France, are sort of questioning whether or not they would join that alliance, because not only are their differences substantively, but they feel that they already have a certain standing as leaders in their own right. So I think that there will be a lot of jostling for place once the votes are all in.
So if the far right in Europe wins enough seats in Parliament, what kind of changes could we be looking at? And do you wonder if these Eurosceptics are ultimately intent on sinking the European project from the inside?
The big ticket items that they're going to be looking at will be, firstly, the approval of the College of Commissioners. So this is the executive body of the EU. If there has been a strong showing from the anti-European parties in the election, then they are likely to use that process to push for some of the members to share their worldview. The second area that they're going to be looking at very closely will be the approval of the new budget. So this is the financial agreement for the next 7 years. But I think the biggest risk that they pose is paralysis, holding up decision making. So it looks like the EU institutions aren't capable of driving forward change on the issues that voters care about.
Susie Denison with the European Council on Foreign Relations, joining us from Paris. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey there, world podcast listener. We're creating a newsletter to help keep all of you up to date with everything we're doing in the world's newsroom. We want you to tell us what you think would be most interesting, most useful for you in a newsletter from the world. So I'm looking at you superfans to help us out and be a part of the world's newsletter focus group. I know you are some of the smartest listeners out there, so your input will be really important to have. Don't worry, it won't take a lot of time. Just send us an email to myworld@theworld.org and write newsletter in the subject line. That's myworld@theworld.org. And thanks. Armenia is not a place we hear about often in the news. It's a small, landlocked country about the size of Maryland. Armenia is also a former republic of the Soviet Union, bordering Turkey to the west and Azerbaijan to the east. Occasionally, though, there's big news from Armenia.
Do you remember that peaceful revolution last year?
The world's Lucy Martirosyan. Hey, Lucy.
Hey, Marco.
So, yeah, I mean, amidst all the upheavals in the world, it was memorable for the activists dancing and playing music in the streets, and kind of surprising that that led to the president stepping down. Right?
Yeah, it was all about people power, and people were hoping for this new Armenia, the LGBTQ community too, but it didn't really work out for them.
I knew that there was homophobia in Armenia, but I didn't know the extent to which it existed.
Who's that?
So this is Brett Burnham. He's an American, and he moved to Armenia to teach public health there at the American University of Armenia. And he told his students, you know, he was being transparent, that he's gay. And that's when the trouble started.
I have been verbally attacked and attacked via email by students viciously, and there's no consequence for them.
And then maybe less than half a year in, the university told him to never come back. They didn't renew his contract, and he doesn't know why.
What does the university actually say?
So they responded to me and said that Brett's sexual orientation had nothing to do with the decision to not renew his contract.
Okay.
All I know is that Brett, you know, he's this outsider, and he felt so discriminated in Armenia for his sexuality that he doesn't even know if he's ever going to come back there. That should give you an idea of where Armenia's at with LGBTQ rights. And I think that's what makes the next part of this story so extraordinary. Okay, so this is at Armenia's National Assembly from a month ago. And it was this parliamentary hearing on human rights.
And who's speaking here?
The speaker, you can tell she's nervous because her shoulders are hunched over and she barely looks up from her page, but there's this kind of determination there that draws you in, even if you don't understand Armenian. Her speech made LGBTQ history in Armenia. She's the first trans woman to ever speak at Armenia's parliament. And her name is Lilit Martirosyan.
Martirosyan, isn't that your...
Yeah, same last name. Right. No, we're not related. So anyway, Lilit spoke for 3 minutes about trans rights, and then this happened.
So for a history-making speech, it sounds like it was not well received.
Not by Naira Zorobyan. She's a prominent member of parliament. Zorobyan told Lilit that her speech was disrespectful and that it didn't fit the agenda that day, so she asked her to leave.
Wow, so what was Lilit's speech all about?
It was a plea for recognition. Lilit told members of parliament about the 283 trans victims who she says have been assaulted, harassed, or even killed in Armenia. And the reason why this is so big is because trans and gay people in Armenia, they have to stay hidden. They have to be hush-hush about their lives.
Lilit, as an activist, she was tired of living like that.
This is Max Varjapetsian. They're translating for Lilit. And Max, by the way, is bigender. They use they-them pronouns. And Max and Lilit, they both work at the Right Side. That's their organization that works to protect and ensure rights for transgender people and sex workers in Armenia. And so it was this huge victory that Lilit, who's the president of this organization, could even speak to Armenia's parliament about trans rights. But then things changed.
We cannot even leave our houses because it is dangerous.
Some Armenians took to the streets. There were nationalists waving the Armenian flag. And there was one member of parliament who called for Lilit to be burned in a square in Yerevan, the capital.
As you can see, it is the 21st century, but people sitting in the National Assembly who must make laws for human rights protection, they stand up and they say that they want to burn us publicly.
The United Nations and the European Union, they both put out statements condemning violence against the LGBTQ community in Armenia. But that's the only backing Lilit has gotten.
There was no support from the government representatives. Nobody even spoke directly to us.
In Armenia, homosexuality has been decriminalized since 2003. But beyond that, there are no protections for gay, lesbian, or bisexual people. And trans people are the most susceptible to harassment and violence. Lilit knows this personally, because she's been attacked on the streets of Yerevan multiple times. most recently 3 months ago.
My teeth were broken and I had very extreme, you know, injuries in the area of my head.
Lilit says the police didn't do anything, not this time, not any of the other times.
What's been the reaction to all of this? Are Armenians' attitudes on this topic changing at all?
Maybe for some, but not for all. Remember Naida Zorobian, the woman in parliament who kicked Lilit out of the National Assembly? I called her up. So Zorobian saying here in Russian that Armenia's society is completely different. It's not that of Britain or Austria or France. And she's saying here that we're not ready to have this conversation in Armenia. Absolutely not ready. And that they need time.
Has anything changed for Lilit?
Well, it's been almost 7 weeks now since she made that speech to Parliament. And things haven't been easy. She can't show her face in public, really, because it's too dangerous. But she's figured out a way to keep working with her activism. And that makes her more determined than ever to stay in Armenia.
The World's Lucy Martirosyan, thanks very much for telling us about this.
Thanks, Marco.
Before we go today, a quick preview of a story we'll have for you tomorrow. Kenya's High Court is expected to rule on whether to repeal a group of laws that target lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. The laws are a century old, discriminatory by Western standards. But in Kenya and other African countries, homosexuality is still seen by many as a crime. So that ruling in Nairobi is likely to echo across the continent. Kenya's High Court considers LGBTQ rights. That's tomorrow, right here on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. As always, thanks for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.